This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. My guest today was once the CEO of a pharmaceutical company in North Carolina, and that same CEO sold the company for $1 billion. And I tell the truth, you were imagining a man, weren't you, in a business suit? Safe to say most of you probably did not picture a woman wearing bright pink from head to toe. Cindy Whitehead is used to surprising people, and she's used to being underestimated. She successfully brought the first medicine to treat low sexual desire in women through the FDA approval process. But the perceived sexism and lack of mentorship she experienced compelled her to change the system. Now she's the CEO of the Pink Ceiling. It's an investment fund and so-called pinkubator that finds and supports women-centric startups with the potential to make a difference. Cindy Whitehead, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Frank. I'm excited to be here.
We're going to talk a little bit about Addy and bringing that product to market and your experiences in the pharmaceutical industry. But tell us about your childhood. You moved around a lot, right?
A lot. Yeah. Every year from 4th through 12th grade, I moved schools. So I was the perpetual new kid. And, you know, the truth is, you look back, I think I went kicking and screaming. My parents can attest I went kicking and screaming. But I look back at it now as a wonderful setup, actually, for what I do, because I was perpetually at the side of the room having to look in and observe. So I perfected listening, and that's helped me along the way.
Always the outsider, and not just moving from neighborhood to neighborhood. You lived on Fiji for a while,
did,
right?
Yeah. I know, before anybody had ever heard of Fiji water, for the record. So I went there, and I was didn't watch television for 2.5 years, came back, complete misfit, but really shaped a lot of my view into the injustices in the world and why you have to do your part.
Well, how so? I mean, were you aware of it at the time? For instance, how old were you in Fiji?
9. Okay. I started there at 9 to 11 years old.
All right. And so how did that, I mean, again, you're the outsider, right? You never quite feel like you belong.
Absolutely.
So how did that shape? I mean, what were you going through? Rather than, well, we'll get to some of your reflections, but in those moments, in that time you were there, I mean, how are you feeling about being there?
It was a fascinating lesson. I think it stoked my curiosity young. I figured out I could learn new things from all different kinds of people. And I absolutely, in the class picture, looked like the outlier, as you might imagine. And what I realized is my good fortune as an American, and understood that also, though, an appreciation for life, even in the absence of having a lot of things. So it was really formative for me spending time in Fiji.
Well, this is interesting. In some ways, you're also aware of your privilege. You just said
Absolutely.
That. So you're going to talk about the ways in which particularly women in the marketplace and in the world of business are discriminated against and sometimes held out. But you also had a sense that as an American,
yeah.
as somebody who was born into a privileged family,
sure.
you had a lot going for you.
No question. I think it gave me an attitude of gratitude every day, seeing those who were less fortunate than me have that attitude and that spirit for life. So that really did teach me, right, I think, from an early age. You know, my father, even when we were young, we used to, at Christmas time, open all of our presents, and we had a discipline that we had to give one of those presents away. Hmm. And we, you know, you're a little kid, you've opened all of these things that were on your list. It's really hard to part with it, you know, an hour later. But that was a good lesson that it's not about the things, and it's about doing your part sort of toward others. Take what you have and pay it forward.
Did you learn early on to ask for something you really didn't want for Christmas?
No, I never did that. Not that cunning, apparently. No, I figured somebody else would want the same things I did.
Now, and you had two brothers, right?
I did, two big brothers.
Yeah. Well,
yes, a secret to the success for sure, having big brothers who in no way, shape, or form thought that their job was to protect me, even though people think that as the little sister. Mm-hmm. They absolutely thought that their job was to toughen me up, and I'm glad they did.
Your father was a diplomat.
He was.
Which is why you traveled
so
much.
Yes, yes. My dad's State Department, political for part of his time, a public servant in every sense of the word. So I learned a lot of that foundation from him.
You spent some time in Washington, D.C.?
I did, yeah. D.C. was always the bounce back place, right, in and out of D.C.
Was that, again, that can be a situation where, particularly if you're a diplomat's child, I found in knowing many people in the diplomatic corps, you're living in pretty privileged circumstances there, too.
Yeah, no question. Well, we had, in D.C., I'm not quite sure. We were pretty much the Griswolds who showed up. We came from very humble beginnings, wrong side of the tracks in Rochester, New York. Every bit a blue-collar, working-class neighborhood, but had this extraordinary, my father had an incredible drive, a drive for public service that ultimately got him into diplomacy, the State Department. And then we had these sort of fantastic experiences that were so unexpected. And I think part of that, you know, being sort of surprised by that privilege helped make it, even it out, if you will, and not take it for granted.
Lived in Washington, D.C., grew up in all over the place, as you said, several schools growing up. How did you imagine yourself? Did you allow yourself to imagine what you were going to do when you grew up, or you're too busy packing?
That's pretty funny. You know, I don't know that I had such clarity. I joke that when I was a very little girl, all of my games were based around me running a business, which is, I don't know that that wasn't set up because it was the only way my brothers would interact with me. So my most famous business, of course, was Cindy's Kitchen, in which I would deliver things from the refrigerator to them on the couch. So I'm pretty sure it was manipulation. But nevertheless, it really did always come down to, you know, me running something and doing it on my own terms.
Oh, but you got paid for it.
Fake coins that were put in my hand, not ever, or maybe Monopoly money if I was really lucky.
Now, but your mother also played a role in this, in terms of how you were seeing yourself and how much control you should be able to have over your own life.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, my mother is a strong woman. She came ultimately, didn't work during all of that time as we were moving every single year. My dad is from upstate New York. My mother's from the Deep South. So we have a mixed family, I like to say. We need a translator at family reunions. But her charm was that femininity. And never allowing anybody to take that away from you, not believing that you have to behave like a guy to succeed in business. That was very important to me to learn that from her.
Did she stress the other part of it, the idea that you didn't have to act like a guy to be successful, but also that you should be confident in navigating that world?
Own it.
Yeah.
She's absolutely, you own it, rely, you know, sort of the strength of independence in your own identity and performance.
Now, it's interesting because we're going to talk about your mentorship, the Pinkubator, helping women's businesses get started and keep them going. Mentorship is important. As you say, your mother didn't work, but she's teaching you a lesson.
Sure.
How did you sort of take that? I mean, she's not in the workforce, but she's clearly very important to you and sending you a very important message.
I took it like mama knows best. That's how I took it. It never... Because of the craziness of our life and constantly moving, make no mistake, my mother was 100% in charge. And that I observed that in how she handled the family and what her expectations of us were and just the strength of her character.
When did you start taking business seriously? When you went to college, you major in business?
I did. Yeah. And I'll tell you, I had a business professor who was really instrumental. I've always loved companies, even from when I was a little girl growing up in Rochester. Crazy story, I'm fanatically loyal to Wegmans, which is a grocery store.
We're going to get four of them by 2020.
I'm so excited about it.
That's the only reason I'm going to stay. I was just about to move back to Western New York.
And there you go.
Wegmans.
All right. I'm telling you, I'm counting the days. When they came to the D.C. area, I was standing outside the day they opened. But, you know, I grew up every Sunday we went to Wegmans. And I loved how it worked. So when I was in college, I had a business professor who her task for me was to constantly report back into her on the best businesses and why they're working. So I would read all the business magazines, and that ultimately shaped where I decided singularly I was going to work when I graduated from college. I was going to work for Fortune's most admired company, which was Merck, and I think she wasn't so sure about the singular focus.
Well, that was interesting. She discouraged you, right?
She did. She said, okay, do you mean pharma? And I said, no, I'm working for Fortune's most admired company to learn the business lessons, and then I'll take them with me anywhere. So she was a little bit worried I was putting all my eggs in one basket. But I got the job. The day I got the job, I called her. I said, I got the job. I told you I would. And she said, great, we're going out to dinner and you're paying.
What would you learn? How long did you stay at Merck and what did you learn?
I was at Merck for about almost 5 years. And I learned that I loved science. So I was in the business to learn business from the best. But what I loved was that ability to really touch lives. I was there at a moment of great excitement. There were a lot of new product launches. It was a day in which Big Pharma still had a lot of research and development in-house. And so there was spectacular emerging science, and that ability to really make an impact was great. What I also learned is I don't fit in big cultures. I don't want to be just a number. And that prompted me, that including one of my big brothers who was already in the startup world, prompted me to go smaller.
You talked about Merck at that time being, you know, the top place to work, not just the most profitable, but a good place to work.
Yep.
And yet it was big. What do you think it was that gave it that distinction, at least by those judges?
In my cynical moments, I would say a great PR department.
Okay, there you go.
But, you know, in fairness, I think what gave it that distinction at that moment in time was innovation, because they were innovating on so many new scientific classes, new classes of drugs. So they were paving the way for other things to come forward.
Well, we'll talk about the difference between big and small, how much a part an individual plays in that kind of success and in that kind of ingenuity, when my conversation with Cindy Whitehead continues. She's the CEO of Pink Ceiling. It's a women-centric investment fund. We'll talk more about her and her journey on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, talking with Cindy Whitehead. Got her start in pharmaceuticals right out of college and ended up in the field of sexual medicine, eventually won FDA approval for Addy, the first medicine that treats low sexual desire in women. She's now investing in other women's ideas with her new investment company, The Pink Ceiling, funds and mentors women-centric startups with products for potential for change and have a mission. We're talking about working at Merck, and I wanted to stick with that a little bit because it is a big company. You talked about innovation, you know, being the thing that drives a lot of people. It's a great place to work because you're working on exciting things. But what about that? We're going to talk about various kinds of corporate and company cultures. That's a big place. How do you maintain a sense that you're contributing to something big, you know, when you're in such a large corporate environment?
The truth is, I don't think I had that, and that's why I went smaller. I think they had a lot of the admiration are these companies who have sort of incredible ways of doing things, or they called it the Merck way. And what I realized is I don't like cultures in which you try to homogenize. You say, okay, this is the way we do things. I don't know, call it my defiant streak. I want that individuality, that opportunity for it. And I knew that in smaller environments, you'd have that latitude of really being yourself. Those are the environments that are, to me, the most interesting and ultimately, in my mind, the most successful.
So what did you do next?
Permission. Yeah. So I went to a company that I thought was so small. It was called Dura Pharmaceuticals. It had 400 people. I laugh when I started my own and we had three. That was really small. So I went to Dura and I moved up through the ranks. I moved up through management. I went inside into corporate and had really my big, probably a defining career moment when Dura was acquired by an Irish company. And at that time, they put together all these businesses they had been buying up in the U.S. because now they had sort of one central force. And I got to be part of that integration team, decide which products we'd keep, what we would divest. It was a how-to in terms of building my own business.
But that's an interesting moment, too, in any corporation's life, because, again, you've got a relatively small company devoted to a particular set of products for a reason. And then you find yourself in this other environment where financial decisions are really dictating everything. Mm-hmm. It's not so much that we need this product or not. This company, its investors need this product or
yeah.
not, right?
Yeah. Well, it's the lesson of, you know, you have to keep the profitable, divest the others. And you actually, what I did like in that opportunity is I got particularly, one of my roles was helping define the culture and going and listening to all these other companies they'd bought so that we could have uniformity and not lose all the strength and talent of the different individual organizations. So that was also great for me. I've always been passionate about culture first. So being able to put my mark on that was important.
So talk about your first company.
Yeah, my first company was Slate Pharmaceuticals right here at the American Tobacco campus. And it was Slate. Truly, in every sense of the word, clean slate. I was going to do it on my own terms. Over the course of my time in the industry, I love the industry for what it could do, the impact it could make. I didn't love how they got it done in every case. So I thought there's got to be other people out there like me who are in big environments. They're successful because they're driven, but they're uninspired. So what if I got them together and gave them permission to be themselves? We find a great product. We see what we can do. And that ultimately was the ride of my life.
So were you expecting, you said, find a great product. Were you going to develop pharmaceuticals?
No, not develop, not go all the way to the bench. So thought at that point in the industry, we could find a product that was out there and maybe a diamond in the rough, and we did. We found a product that was, at the time, the only FDA-approved testosterone replacement, long-acting testosterone replacement for men, and so began my path in sexual medicine specifically.
And again, talk about, maybe we'll do a quick 101 in the pharmaceutical industry, because it is interesting. You talk about not going back to the bench. Somebody has to do really bedrock research, R&D. But then there's a whole industry in getting FDA approval.
Sure.
Just that part of it, and doing the trials is another part of it. And then, of course, the marketing,
mm-hmm.
all of that.
Mm-hmm.
Which, did you see yourself sort of staying in that business, that part of the business where you're sort of trying to identify products that have already been created and maybe bringing them to market?
I think I saw the magic in those things that can be often forgotten. And that's the same story of Addy, really, ultimately, when I took it on for Sprout. So I love, scientists can become so consumed in the lab, they miss that one that has this unbelievable commercial potential, and really that ability to be a first or a groundbreaker. So I do think that became the strength in both of those companies, and taking it all the way through sort of FDA and ultimately marketing.
What is the most, I'm going to ask you to create a hierarchy for me. I understand that it's pretty complex. But when it comes to this kind of science and medicine, marketing is certainly critical. We know that in the pharmaceutical industry. What are you looking for? Are you looking for something you can market? Obviously, the test, there's some scientific results on effectiveness, mm-hmm. side effects, all of that. That's, anybody can read that. So what are you looking for as someone who's going to pick this up and push it the next step?
Well, I'm looking for great science. Foundationally, great science is the most important thing, that it does work, the safety profile. And then, for me, what ignites me are those things that are maybe some of the taboo areas, things where we can make a value judgment. Here's what is dangerous in science. We say everything comes down to benefit risk, and that sounds very objective, and yet it can be quite subjective, because if we assign no value to the benefit of something, then any risk would be too great. And I think we can make value judgments in certain conditions that really hold up progress, and that's what I thought was happening around female sexual dysfunction.
I want to get to that in just 1 minute. I want to talk more about how you did that, because you talked about Slate. Your first company was three people, right?
At the beginning. we grew. Sure.
So how do you do those assessments? Do you bring that, those? Do you hire the scientist who can do the assessments for you, or do you
find the scientist? Found the scientist. In that case, with Slate, it was a brilliant formulator from New York. He had a product, he had a business with it, but he'd never really gone out and marketed it to the right audience. So interestingly, this drug was being used off-label in women, which was wrong. And so it really should have been used by urologists in men, and so saw that opportunity to go out and build a specialty organization. So not so many salespeople that it was untenable, and we built it to, actually in 4 years, we were the second most prescribed testosterone among urologists. So we had quite a rocket ship ride doing that.
All right, so talk about Addy and how you got connected with that.
Well, I'll tell you. So here I am in this field of sexual medicine. It's a relatively small community, an exciting community, because a lot of our learnings are relatively new there. I'm watching this spectacular science emerge in terms of our understanding of what unlocks desire in women, and I'm watching company after company turn and walk away. And it became clear to me it wasn't the science. It was the narrative. It was this belief system that we can't ever get it through, basically, for women. And I had one particular physician who is a pioneer in the field of sexual medicine. He actually was the principal investigator that got Viagra approved for men. And he was in trials, doing research on this drug. And then the company that had originally innovated it made a decision they were going to put it on the shelf. They were going to walk away. And his name is Irwin Goldstein. Dr. Irwin Goldstein had his patients, they had to call their patients back in and deliver this news to them. They didn't know what they were coming in for. So he said in this particular research visit, "You mind if I film this one?" Women said, "Sure." And he said to them, "Listen, they're killing the development program. I need to get all your medication back from you today." And I watched these women with their hands shaking and tearing up. And he said to me, as he showed me these videos, "You need to do something about this." So in many ways, the opportunity chose me.
This is when Addy was dropped.
Yeah.
Now. And so what did you do next? Because there had to be, why did the company say they were dropping it?
I'll this, they hit a roadblock with the FDA. It's not surprising. It was brand new, first in class. That happens about 80% of the time. They asked them to go do more work, but they decided not to go do more work because of a lot of the cultural conversation that was coming up around it. And so what I did, here's my secret. I listened. I spent a whole year and went and listened to women who had the condition, what it meant for their lives, what their definition of success was. And when I got done with that year, I thought, by God, everybody else is going to listen too. And I ended up selling off my high-flying business in men, and swallowed really hard, turned around to my investors and said, give me some money back. We're going again.
Well, let me talk about the slate. I don't want to get past that too quickly because that was you. You were cited by the FDA, I think, for using misleading marketing claims at Slate. I think for this drug for men. So talk more about that and that whole case.
About Testapel. Look, we were early in our development. They didn't like some of our claims. FDA writes a number, probably 80 to 100 of these letters a year, and we. Ultimately, we rectified it with the agency. We worked directly with them and took it right through. They didn't like some of the claims. They were similar to claims being made by other testosterones, but we were the new kids on the block. And when they tell you that, you comply. Really that straightforward. It's not so uncommon. I think it sounds very uncommon or very alarming in pharma. You take it seriously, but we weren't the only one receiving that letter in that year.
And then you comply and you adjust the language. So now talk more about Addy, because the FDA was saying, look, this doesn't, it's just the effectiveness rates are not very high in women. I think I saw somewhere something like 10%. And then sort of the complexity of knowing whether or not it's addressing precisely what it is in women that accounts for their low sexual desire. The link wasn't clear, as I understand.
60% of women in our clinical trials were responders, and we studied it in 11,000 women. So we were the largest ever new drug application for women. It's very interesting. I think a lot of that concept around effectiveness was, if anything, precipitated by this misnomer of female Viagra. Right? It's such a sexy catchphrase. The media loved it. It's what they called it. But in no sense of the word is it female Viagra. Women are not, and this surprises no woman who's listening here right now, women are not on demand when it comes to sex. In fact, desire is unlocked in the brain. So if you understand that construct, suddenly you don't believe that this on-off switch is going, or off-on, if you will, but you really understand that it's more akin to what happens when we take an antidepressant. If we're depressed, there's a restoration effect back to normal. So it's subtle shifts. And if you listen to women in the trials, it was about having a spontaneous fantasy that reminded them that, you know, they have drive. Or it was, being out with their husband on a date night and going, okay, bring the check, like, let's go. But it wasn't this immediate turn on that everybody expected it to be by calling it female Viagra. And that's just, again, that's our lack of understanding about female sexuality.
So, and again, implicit, a kind of an implicit bias. If you understand sexuality from the male perspective, and mostly men are running the business and doing the trials, then it might be hard for you to understand that way of being sexual.
Look, no question there's unconscious bias. And I would tell you, particularly, you can amplify that tenfold when it comes to sex, because we all think we know everything about it based on our own experience or what we learned maybe when we were taught in high school. I don't know. But in truth, actually pervasively across healthcare, one of the issues when it comes to women's health is we tend to acknowledge or accept point blank that all things for men that are going wrong are biological. And then we think that the things going wrong for women are psychological. And in truth, we're underselling both genders. Many conditions are multifactorial, they're complex, and you have to take both of those things into consideration. And what bothered me was the fact that we didn't even acknowledge the possibility that something was going wrong for a woman biologically when it came to sex, when she went into the bedroom. And we knew it because there was brain scan imaging that showed us that.
And that's the other thing I think that you're getting at. When you allow this implicit bias to continue and it becomes part of the business structure and business culture, you're missing a lot of science. I mean, maybe you can assume that because Viagra and Cialis and these other products work on the vascular system and the other works sort of that these are two different systems, but there's a lot of feeding back. If the vascular system is changed, there's a lot that goes on in the mind that changes. And again, if you don't see the thing as a whole, your science is going to be bad from that day forward.
Absolutely. I think so many misconceptions in this particular category and so many myths, and it really was unfair because what the answer to that was patting these women on the shoulder who had a biological medical condition, which they couldn't will away or therapy away. And yet we were telling them, hey, just, you know, relax, go on a vacation. And it was so sad to watch that impact with them, particularly. I'll tell you, this woman, as I went through this process, and it was not easy, it was a roller coaster ride, what kept me going was going back to my inbox, because women wrote me every day and told me, keep fighting the fight. Thank you for telling me I'm not alone. And one woman in particular, went just before I made the decision to dispute the FDA, wrote me a letter, said she lived outside of D.C., and she'd been in the clinical trial. She wanted to share her experience with me. So I show up. She walks into the room. This woman is in charge in every sense of the word. Type A, runs her own business, raised two beautiful boys. And she says to me, I have succeeded in every aspect of my life other than this. And I watched a woman who was turning on herself, that it was her. If only I bought better lingerie, if only I read more 50 Shades of Grey, whatever it was. And yet for her, it was biological. So I open my MacBook. I start showing her the brain scan studies, geeking out, telling her this. And I turn to her. She's completely crying. And that moment of validation is exactly why I kept going.
So you did keep going. Initially, the FDA rejected the drug. Then you responded with a campaign called Even the Score. Tell us about it.
So one of 26 members of the group of Even the Score, which was a combination of different health companies. We had some health advocates, health rights advocates, and women's rights advocates. So an interesting group, everything from consumer to National Organization for Women, as well as some different companies in it. And the idea was prompted by 10 different women's rights and health groups had a meeting with the FDA. I wasn't part of that meeting, but I got to hear from them that what they really felt and the FDA thought that, yeah, we had 26 drugs at that point for men. We had said 26 times yes to turning over the decision to men. And that maybe something was disconnecting, because it wasn't that nobody had tried for women. And so what they gave was an opportunity for a voice, for women to come in and really share their stories. And remarkably, and to the credit of the FDA, they opened their doors and they listened.
So what is that? What combination of sort of consciousness raising about the science, but also just pure politics? I mean, getting the meeting that causes you to listen again to this argument. What do you think is the mix there?
Well, I think advocacy is at the heart of those complicated or taboo conditions. If you look at what happened even with, you know, medications for HIV, similarly, we know the story that it took patients kind of rising and saying, this is me, and I get to make the choice. And actually, I'm philosophically right there with them. This is my belief. We absolutely need the FDA to protect consumer safety, 100%. We don't need them to make value judgments on which conditions are worth treating. And we ultimately, as a drug company, our responsibility is rigor in which we characterize the benefits and the risks. If there's a showstopper in the risk, it never goes. But once we've characterized that, I think it's our obligation to turn it over to patients and their healthcare providers to make the decision.
It finally did get approved for that purpose. What happened next to the company?
I'll tell you, it got approved because they held a scientific meeting. So they have a mechanism. It was the first time anybody had looked at our full data set, and they voted 3-1 to approve the drug.
How did they reject it without looking at your full data set?
Well, they had looked at they asked us to do more work. So it was the first time there had been a public opportunity for the FDA to assemble experts in the condition. You know, FDA can't be experts in all conditions. We're the first ever drug in this particular condition. And we're in a division that mostly does hormones. So we weren't in the CNS division or the central nervous system division, which would have understood this mechanism more. So they invited in a panel of experts to help them decide. But when we sold it, it was, you know, science won, and so too did women.
You did? You sold the company for
$1 billion? $1 billion, yes.
Cash?
Cash up front, yes.
Tell us again who bought the company.
Valiant bought the company.
So Valiant bought the company. And we're going to talk more about, maybe we can get this conversation started because it still has, they're not marketing it heavily at the moment.
Correct.
Right?
That's right. It's, you know, and it's heartbreaking for, I think, those of us who were early days of the crusade, if you will, for women to have this first. And yet, because of the state of things at their company, it's not a priority at this moment. So we wait every day for them to really put marketing and disease state education behind it.
Don't blame this show. It's not the state of things. We didn't do it. I want to talk more about that, about what you do after this enormous business success.
Sure.
And talk more about some of the science as well. And about the Pink Ceiling, an effort to help women entrepreneurs, women businesses, and women-focused businesses get going. I'm talking to Cindy Whitehead, who's the CEO of the Pink Ceiling, a women-centric investment fund. We'll talk about that on the State of Things. Please do stay tuned. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking with Cindy Whitehead, CEO of the Pink Ceiling, an organization that invests in and champions companies made by and for women. Cindy successfully pushed for FDA approval of Addy, the first drug to treat hypoactive sexual desire in that disorder in women. And she realized that she was not alone in doing this business, but also in the need for mentorship and in promoting women's businesses. I want to talk more about sort of if there's a need for this. You found the need as you worked Addy through the process. But again, if you find now Valiant owns it, it bought the company from you or bought the product from you and then isn't promoting it. If the demand is out there, why not promote it? Why not sell it?
Does anybody know it's there? right now. So I think for them, look, Valiant's gone through their own interesting difficulties as a business. There's a new CEO in. It was the last product in. It actually was an outlier for them. And that was very intentional when they acquired us. I mean, the idea was that they would acquire us and get to do what they did. They love to do, which is just be highly acquisitive. The offer was, hey, Cindy, you build this. You operate as Sprout, and we'll go buy you all of the great innovation in women's health. Sounded great to me. But because of business circumstances, that couldn't happen. It is a great market. It's the first and only of its kind. If you look at the data for the impact of this for women across the globe, and one of the reasons I sold them was the ability to globalize this, it'll come.
Let's talk about the business, the pharmaceutical industry for a while. I certainly want to get into the Pink Incubator and the Pink Ceiling and some of your aspirations for helping women in business. But I just sort of take a theoretical look at the way this business is set up. We think about pharmaceuticals helping us, modern science, and the promise it has. But the fact is, it's got to be a business first. And so it just has always seemed to me that what you have to do is appeal to investors and not necessarily people's needs. So you're looking for illnesses to treat from people who can afford to pay for it, right? I mean, it's not about making the world healthier, right? I mean, fundamentally?
In smaller companies, I would disagree. I think in big companies, it got there. And actually, all of the spend on R&D almost had to go away and count on these small businesses to be the innovators that then get gobbled up by the big because they need that pipeline. I think if you look at those companies, my case study in terms of Sprout, deeply passionate about the mission and the integrity of the science and the ability to make a real impact in someone's life. So I think everybody loves the pharmaceutical industry at 3 a.m. in the morning when their children is really their child is really sick in bed, but hate them in the light of day. And look, it's the fault of the industry. I think that they have overpriced and they have really reputationally hurt it for everybody, including the little guys.
But it does mean even as a small, especially as a small business, I get it. You're passionate. You want to do this thing. You can't ignore investors. You have to say, I have to produce a product that has a huge financial reward at the end as a promise. And that means maybe not. I mean, we'll go back to the 10-90 split and curing malaria doesn't necessarily get me an investor.
Well, listen, I got to tell you, it's capital intensive pharma. It takes many years, 12 years, 15 years. You've spent a lot of money. Every time the FDA asked me to do another study, I had to turn around to my investors and say, that'll be another $10 million, $5 million. Mm. And so you do obviously, look, my job as a CEO is to have built a profitable business and pay back the shareholders who bet on me. And the good news is when you do that, and I think the luxury for me in an exit was getting to sit back and watch the ripple effect of those who did well and how they now are paying it forward too. And the ways they're paying it forward may be in a profit-making scenario, but they keep turning around and giving that profit to the next inventor, to the next innovator, to the next business CEO, which is great.
So talk about the genesis of the pink ceiling.
Yeah, so the pink ceiling was sort of the perfect job. Right after an exit like that, you really get to take stock. For me, I'd had a front row lesson in what it means for women to advocate for themselves and each other. So that was going to be central. I was going to create a bunch of owners because I'd now watched that ripple effect of ownership and the impact that can make on lives. And the final thing is I had to rip the sheets out, you know, covers off every morning and jump out of bed. And for me, that's fighting injustice. That's what has always done it my whole life. And in the pink ceiling, I get to invite, you know, I get to fight the injustice of women's lack of access to capital. Women get only 2% of venture funding. 2% by last year's data. Mm. You cannot tell me that 50% of the population has 2% of the good ideas. Mm. Something is wrong with that system. And the other piece is that mentorship. I've been there. I've done it. Now I can reach my arm back and pull somebody there faster than I got there myself.
So what does it look like? Who do you work with?
So we basically have, we invest in early stage companies. Most of them, it turns out, are scientists or engineers, and my business team surrounds them and helps propel them to market. And we also mentor women sort of at every stage of business in a separate program through the Pinkubator.
And so you're waiting for the women. You're not finding just entrepreneurs. These are businesses that are already set up.
No, they're many times very early stage. So they're raising their first round. Maybe they're raising their Series A round. And they have an idea. They've already put some work behind it. There's a proof piece there. But I have different stages of businesses, all early.
And talk about this percentage, again, 2% of venture capital going to women. I mean, we're talking about wealth building here,
yeah,
now, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Or access to capital. It's not just a lot of good ideas that aren't going to come to market.
Right.
This is the difference between income and wealth, owning your own business, right?
It is. Look, ownership is the path to freedom. And the path is not only financial freedom, but hopefully it's freedom to make the decisions that you want. And inside of the Pinkubator, we say that our unofficial tagline is make women really rich. And I get interesting responses to that. But what I know is that that is really the way you start to change things, is to give women that money to then invest in the ideas that they believe in, to invest in other women. And by all data, they will do that. They will pay it forward. And it's frankly a condition of working with us at Pinkubator.
And you're making a financial investment.
I do.
You have an equity stake in these companies,
yeah.
So you've got some skin.
I have skin. I believe to my core skin in the game. Mm-hmm. In every business that I've built, I've made everybody shareholders. Whatever they did inside of the organization, it helps you make decisions differently, right, if you're an owner. And they deserve that reward. I wouldn't have gotten there without their hard work every single day. And that was missing in big environments for me, too. You didn't feel that you had that skin in the game. And it's a very different sense of motivation.
What about the mentorship? You obviously have experience. Who are your other mentors?
Oh, well, for me personally, who are my mentors? Now I feel lucky that my Rolodex is filled with people who I would consider mentors. And part of what I do inside of Pinkubator is open that up to others. So experts in different areas than me and give them access to that. But for my mentorship, I never had a formal mentor.
Right.
You know, as I was going along in business, there was nobody who looked like me at the top. And so the good news is I think it fostered that looking to my left and my right and realizing that everybody can teach you something and really getting peer-to-peer mentorship. And now I would say reverse mentorship with my team, many of whom are younger than me and school me on things every day.
Going back to that advice your mother gave you or that model that she created for you, that you don't have to lose your femininity to the extent that it's expressed in clothes and other things and becomes distinct from something we would call masculinity, culturally driven, of course. But it's something that you've experienced because you like to wear pink. And
I do.
You showed up and made your presentations, you found that men weren't always taking you seriously.
My best advice to women in business is prepare to be underestimated and then show up and kill them with competence. That is my best prepare to be, because if you're not prepared, what I think it does is it pushes you back, either in frustration or self-doubt. And so you've got to learn how to overcome that and go from underestimated to just unapologetically you, which is why I wear pink. I like pink. And I think that being a woman in business gives me different things to offer than men, and I'm not going to go away from that. Pink for me is a lot about owning it as a woman, owning that femininity.
But what is the advice? Because I know there's always a question like this, a question for women in particular. We can talk about other groups that find themselves discriminated against, to what extent they need to assimilate and seem like the dominant group, wear the pantsuit, show the guys, and don't raise any questions, or assert the fact that I can come up here and look any way I want. I got the stuff. I know what I'm talking about. You need to pay attention to me.
I would say perfect your sense of humor. I would say never be in an environment in which you cannot be yourself. Yeah. Move. That's my
how you've done it. You've moved. I mean, talk about that. You've been in cases where, you know.
For sure. Along the way, I've had a lot of interesting, what I would say, discriminatory things happen. And I just decided it's not the place for me. And I kept moving. And I think that can be you can be fearful to do that. Look, I had a woman come up to me. I spoke recently at the Inc. Women's Summit. And she came up, and she's in a completely male-dominated industry, meatpacking. And she said to me, "Listen, I need some advice. I cannot take anybody out to dinner anymore because I keep getting hit on." Beautiful young woman. And I said, "Let me ask you a question. Do your competitors take them out to dinner?" She said, "Well, of course they do. That's the only time we can get with them." I said, "Well, you're not going to stop going to dinner. So what are you going to do?" And she sort of looked at me, and I said, "If a guy hits on you, say, 'Oh, don't be so cliche. That happened last time. If you need help, I'll help you at the bar.'" Start putting it out there. Or before you go to dinner, say, "Hey, listen, don't even try to hit on me. The last guy did." Put it out there, because the good guys are not going to be offended. They're going to know that something happened. And if a guy was thinking about it, he actually will, I think, reality check and go, "Oh, God, was I going to do that?"
Let's talk business. Yeah. You had that experience, I think, one time giving a presentation wearing a pink. The guys were all chatting among themselves, and then you put up the brain signs.
Can you imagine me showing up in all pink talking about sex and women? First of all, I don't look like a pharmaceutical executive. And here I am talking about sex, which automatically gets a reaction. Right. I was at a really important conference, the J.P. Morgan Healthcare Conference, and presenting about Addy. And it was a spectacular opportunity for me. I had these 8 minutes up there. So I get up there, start to talk, and the whole room is giggling. Giggling. And In this moment, my counter is going down, so I start to advance my slides as fast as I can, and I got to the brain scan images, and I went silent, and I pointed, and I waited long enough for the crowd to get quiet, and I said, "Are you looking at what I'm looking at? Because I'm just talking about the biology of sex for women." And it taught me a lesson that I was going to have to do it differently, but I was going to be strong in terms of what I was talking about and demand the attention deserved.
I'm going to get into some pretty dicey territory here, but there is some research that suggests that women do business when they own their own businesses in slightly different ways. And we've seen some research on a more collaborative style that women bring to, but whether it's public policy or business. With your experience, is something like that true? Is it worth talking about, and is it worth nurturing, or is that just more of the prejudice?
Here's what I would like to talk about. I'd like to talk about the empathy that women bring to business. And I talk a lot about, you know, rule breakers, the disruptors. And it's not that you're breaking those rules of law and order in society. We have to have those. But women are subjected to many more unwritten rules, in my mind. And it takes real sort of aggravation and I think the drive of empathy for them to disrupt that. I find that women solve problems for themselves, for others. And that, I think, is a unique strength, particularly if you look at how business is going and everything is by spreadsheet and by, you know, zeros and ones. We're going to lose that human touch. And so I think it's a particularly unique strength that women are going to bring to the C-suite, is that, you know, empathy can inform data very differently.
And can it make for a more successful business? Because it seems to me that if there's anything to it, apart from the fact that it sounds like maybe a more fun place to work, it would spread if we could allow more businesses to be owned by women.
I think if you could appreciate what that brings to the table. For me, with Addy, we wouldn't have ever gotten there if nobody had ever shown up and listened. And they'd really put themselves in somebody else's shoes and then demanded that the science be paid attention to. The science had already given us the answer. All the other was this value judgment. And I think that that drive of empathy I see in other women. I see in the women who come into the Pinkubator, why they're solving these problems. And I think increasingly that's going to be a gap strength that comes in.
We saw that flap over the Google employee who, you know, came up with a 10-page manifesto on, on the scientific reasons, in quotes.
Sure.
That women are not suited for this business. It's not surprising that there's a human being in this world who thinks that. The amount of attention it got, how did you feel about that?
Listen, if anybody, that is the underpinning of why what is so wrong in the Valley is that we're not talking about it. But in fact, this unconscious bias is there. And this belief that women don't have the chops. I mean, it is all of the foundation for why women were told to show up and act like a man and dress like a man and talk like a man. And you know, really, if you look at early women in business who were wildly successful, they had to do that. And I'm just adamantly against having to do that at this point. When I'm mentoring younger female entrepreneurs or women growing in the business ranks, I am saying, do not give up what you uniquely bring to the table. Women have all the chops to go. Different exits. I'm certainly sitting in front of you, self-made, you know, humble beginnings, absolutely could go out there and do it and not give up my own identity.
What else do you think accounts for that very low rate of venture capital invested in women's businesses? Is it just that aren't enough women's businesses out there? Or?
No, it's not that. It is actually, there's so many interesting studies. Even Harvard just did a piece with the different ways, if given the same presentation, how many more male business, exact same presentation, the male business will get funded, not the female. They talk about language patterns and describing that are so different. I tweet about this stuff all of the time. Let me be sympathetic for a second that it's not all a group of guys sitting across the table going, I'm not going to invest because she's a woman. It's human nature, right? If they can't relate to it, if I'm bringing forward to them the first ever drug for female sexual dysfunction and they can't relate, they're unlikely to invest in it. Investors are human. Similarly, I'll put myself on the spot. If somebody brought me the next biggest invention in golf and I don't golf, I'd probably go, uh-uh. But if they said to me, okay, Cindy, I know you're not a golfer, but I need you to go out and I need you to talk to all of your friends who golf. And when I talked to all my friends who golfed and they said, oh my gosh, I would use it tomorrow, I would think about investing. But that is still disconnecting. That ask isn't being made of the other side of the table, and the human element is causing them to not invest. What will change that is when more women are on the other side of the table.
Cultivated human nature, right? It's changing that nature to be more open and to ask more questions, to listen
ask
more carefully.
Questions, yeah.
Cindy Whitehead, CEO of The Pink Ceiling in Raleigh. The company invests in women-centric startups with great ideas and mentors women in all stages of entrepreneurship. Cindy, what a pleasure. Thank you so much for talking with us. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org, a program produced by Anita Rao, Charlie Sheldon Orman, Laura Pelliser, and Jennifer Brookland. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.